The orders of the court are hereby pronounced and are posted outside and in the clerk's office and available for your inspection. This morning, the court has three matters to be submitted by oral argument. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Union Carbide Corporation and others versus the Honorable B.D. Moy on original mandamus proceeding. L.M. Bazile versus Aetna Casualty and Surety Company and others from Harris County. And N.D. Anderson Jr. and others versus the City of Seven Points, Texas. And Walter Tolliver, Mayor Pro Tem from Henderson County. In the first clause, the court is allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. In the second and third clauses, the court has allotted 15 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel in the second and third clauses do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being presented, but please remain nearby. All of these arguments are being recorded for the court's convenience. Should you desire to listen to the tapes of these arguments, you may make application with the clerk of our court. The court is now ready to hear oral argument from Relator in Union Carbide Corporation versus Moy.
May it please the court, Mr. T. Michael Young and Professor William D. Bertania II will present argument for the petitioner. Mr. Young will vote.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Michael Young, and together with Bill Dorsanio, I represent the relators in this action, who are the 290 defendants in the underlying litigation in Morris County, Texas, represented by 98 different law firms. Following my own presentation, Mr. Dorsanio will address the 1983 amendments to the venue rules and will discuss the analogy to the criminal practice with respect to motions for change of venue. Morris County is one of Texas' smallest counties, but this case is the largest case ever filed in Morris County. There are in excess of 2,300 individual plaintiffs, and by the time consortium claims are counted, there are over 4,200 individual claimants. Of these, approximately 30%, or around 1,300, are Morris County claimants. The evidence shows that each of these Morris County residents has an average of 11.5 relatives within the third degree of relationship residing in Morris County. And that means that even if overlap is considered, the very large proportion of the approximately 8,000 Morris County registered voters will be either plaintiffs or relatives of plaintiffs. By the time one adds close friends, business associates, employers, employees, neighbors, and so forth, it is apparent that virtually every Morris County juror will have a close relationship to one or more of the plaintiffs in this case. Over and above these demographic problems, the defendants face other potential obstacles to a fair trial in Morris County. And many of these arise from the association of the defendants as suppliers to Lone Star Steel. There have been massive layoffs at the Lone Star Steel plant in Morris County, which is Morris County's largest employer. And those layoffs have resulted in an unemployment rate exceeding 30%, severe hardship for many Morris County residents, and an economic climate where judgments paid by the defendants will have a direct and significant impact on the depressed local economy. The defendants further face animosity toward Lone Star Steel over environmental issues arising from Lone Star Steel's subsidiary's proposal to locate Texas' largest hazardous waste incinerator in Morris County and the organized public opposition to that project. Finally, the defendants find in Morris County an extremely close-knit community, one in which news of these lawsuits has become a major news item spread by word of mouth throughout the county, and in which news of settlements by two co-defendants has been widespread and has convinced many Morris County residents that all the defendants are liable. To overcome these obstacles, Rule 257 motions were filed and adopted by virtually all of the defendants. A pretrial order was entered providing for disclosure and discovery of the witnesses to be called at the hearing on these motions. Extensive discovery was undertaken, and extensive logistical preparations for the hearing were made. But on the morning of the hearing, as the first witness was being called to the stand, the plaintiffs presented an extensive written opposition to the hearing of oral testimony. The trial court sustained that opposition and considered the motions to change venue on the basis of the written record assembled prior to the close of the hearing. The trial court employed what the plaintiffs have characterized as a summary judgment process, notwithstanding the requirement of Rule 258 that the issue of impartiality be, quote, tried by the judge, close quote. Despite the existence of clear issues of material fact in the record before the court, the trial court denied the motion to change venue. Now, in denying an evidentiary hearing on the motion, the trial court blurred the distinction between conventional venue transfer and change of venue due to inability to receive an impartial trial. Those two concepts have different historical antecedents. They are embodied in different statutes and procedural rules, and they have a fundamental difference in their purpose.
Does the rule make that differentiation?
The rule makes very clear that differentiation, Your Honor. Rules 86 through 89 are replete with references to the fact that impartial trial venue is governed by Rules 257 through 259. Professor D'Arsanio will go through each of the rules individually, but that point is made very clear in Rules 86 through 89. The purpose of conventional venue is to balance the relative convenience to the parties, to weigh the plaintiff's right to choose the forum against the defendant's right to be sued in a forum that has some connection to the facts of the case or to the parties. The purpose of impartial trial venue is much more profound, and that is to guarantee that what is to come will be fair and will afford justice to the parties, as is their constitutional right. The difference in purpose between the two concepts leads logically to a difference in standards of proof. Conventional venue is governed by the prima facie standard of proof. All that is at issue is relative convenience, and to prevent the venue determination from itself being a source of inconvenience, disputes in the evidence are simply disregarded. If prima facie proof of proper venue is made, the plaintiff wins. Impartial trial venue, on the other hand, involves a full factual inquiry where the issue is tried by the judge. There can be no shortcuts, there can be no presumptions, because what is at stake is the constitutional right to a fair trial, which is at the heart of the decision-making process. Now, the difference in standards of proof leads to a difference in methods of proof. The prima facie standard applicable to conventional venue lends itself readily to determination on a written record, because if that written record reveals factual disputes, they may simply be disregarded. Impartial venue, on the other hand, involves the preponderance of the evidence standard and requires a mechanism for resolving disputed issues of material fact, and that cannot meaningfully be done on a written cold record. In 1983, the statute and rules regarding venue were extensively revised, but those revisions preserved rather than abolished the distinction between conventional venue and impartial trial venue. We know that first from the language of the statute. Section 15064 speaks of factual proof to, quote, establish venue, close quote. In a Rule 257 inquiry, no one questions that venue has been established, and the question is whether it should be changed notwithstanding the fact that it has been established for other reasons, reasons related to impartiality. The statute also speaks of factual proof regarding the merits of the case. That, of course, was a central issue under the old plea of privilege practice for conventional venue, but it was not in 1983 and has never been an issue in impartial trial venue change. We know also from the legislative history that the court is instructed to look to the old law, the evil, and the remedy. The old law was Articles 1995 and 2008. 1995, of course, dealt solely with conventional venue transfer, and 2008 was the jurisdictional provision for interlocutory venue appeals. And the legislative history of the 1983 amendments indicates clearly that their primary purpose was to eliminate the requirement that the plaintiff make a threshold showing of the merits of his cause of action. And as I've said, that was always an issue under plea of privilege practice, but was never an issue under impartial trial practice. Now, the plaintiffs simply don't come to grips with how a factual dispute regarding the impartiality of the forum is to be resolved. They say that procedures resembling a summary judgment were properly employed, but of course summary judgment practice is designed to deal with undisputed issues of fact, not disputed issues of fact. What they have to be arguing is that the standard for impartial trial venue transfer is the same as the standard for conventional venue transfer, namely a prima facie standard under which disputes in the evidence are simply disregarded, and if there is a dispute, the plaintiff wins. Well, first of all, that would render totally meaningless the tried by the judge language of Rule 258. If upon the filing of a controverting affidavit, the matter is at an end and the plaintiff wins, then there is nothing left to be tried by the judge. But perhaps more importantly than that, it would reduce the constitutional right to a fair trial and the elaborate procedure established by the rules for guaranteeing that right to a situation where we examine the county to see if one affiant can be found in whose opinion the defendants can receive a fair trial. And if one person in the county can be found, then regardless of whether a fair trial can actually be had, the plaintiff prevails and the defendant is held in the forum. We believe that Rule 258 practice is analogous to summary judgment practice. Under Rule 258, the movement must produce affidavits demonstrating his inability to get a fair trial in the forum, just as a summary judgment movement must present affidavits demonstrating his right to prevail as a matter of law. If those affidavits go uncontroverted, then under Rule 258, the movement automatically prevails. Just as if a summary judgment movement has met his burden of proof and his affidavits go uncontroverted, he obtains a summary judgment. But finally, if the affidavits are controverted, then the issue of the impartiality of the forum is joined and is to be tried by the judge. Just as in summary judgment practice, if summary judgment affidavits are controverted, then issue is joined, the summary judgment motion must be denied, and the issue must be tried by the judge or jury. In this case, there was as the plaintiffs admit, a clear dispute in the evidence regarding the impartiality of the forum. But the trial court nevertheless granted the equivalent of a summary judgment on the issue of impartiality. What should the trial court have done? We need look no further than Rule 258. Upon the filing of the controverting affidavit, that rule required that the issue thus joined be tried by the judge. Unless the court has questions, I would yield at this point to Professor Grossani.
Yes, I'd like to know a little more about the circumstances of the hearing. Had there been any exchange of information concerning what witnesses would appear at this hearing?
Yes, Your Honor. There was a pretrial order to which both parties agreed that set forth a sequence of disclosure of the witnesses.
For this particular hearing?
For this particular hearing, and it referred to witnesses to be called at the hearing.
And had the trial judge set out a certain amount of estimated time that this hearing would take?
Yes, Your Honor. He had blocked out an 8-week block of time from his schedule and, in fact, had continued the hearing so that he would have an 8-week block of time in which to hear it. The courtroom in Morris County was too small to accommodate all of the parties and their counsel, and so a high school auditorium had been rented by the county for the purpose of holding this hearing.
And then an ambush occurred.
Well, that's our position, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Counsel.
May it please the Court, Professor Grossani will continue arguments with the petitioner.
If the Court please, in the closing days of the 68th legislature on May 28, 1983, Senate Bill 898 was finally passed. The passage of the bill left to this Court the difficult task of promulgating procedural rules within a period of weeks that would correspond with the statutory provisions in order to implement the new venue scheme. The task was difficult because of the fact that the general provisions of Senate Bill 898 that are now in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code are somewhat cryptic and unclear with respect to procedural issues. For example, and among the more difficult questions that this Court had to address in amending the venue rules are how should the impartial trial and consent to transfer references in paragraph 4C, now Civil Practice and Remedies Code section 15.063, be interpreted, and how should the propriety of the plaintiff's venue choice be determined from the pleadings and affidavits? What would happen in the event of a tie on the basis of pleadings and affidavits? These issues, among others, caused this Court and its committees to attempt to revise Rules 86 through 89 and 257 through 259 to correspond with the statutory scheme, while at the same time to give meaning to the procedural requirements that would attend the various types of venue issues. The long and short of it is that impartial trial questions were left to Rules 257 through 259, where they had been since the predecessor statutes were incorporated in the Rules of Civil Procedure by this Court in 1939. Rules 86 through 89 make it clear from the standpoint of every significant aspect that Rules 257 through 259 govern impartial trial questions. In the first place, The question of due order is addressed in the first paragraph of Rule 86. The second sentence provides a motion to transfer venue because an impartial trial cannot be had in the county where the action is pending is governed by the provisions of Rule 257. There is an explicit reference to Rule 257 with respect to the time to file motions to change venue governed by Rule 257. There is no due order requirement in Rule 257. There is a due order requirement in Rule 86 for conventional venue. By the same token, the important provisions of Rule 87 also cross-refer to Rules 257 through 259. The significant part, the part that dealt with the question as to should a tie go to the plaintiff in the context of a proper venue issue, that is addressed in paragraph 3, cross-refers in paragraph 3C to Rules 257 and 259 in this way. If a claimant has adequately pleaded and made prima facie proof that venue is proper in the county of suit, then the cause shall not be transferred. But the rule goes on to say, unless an impartial trial cannot be had in the county where the action is pending as provided in Rules 257 through 259. The matter is left to those rules.
I understand your argument about how the rules break down and the word trial in Rule 257. And the explicit references in the earlier rules to this separate scheme. But what about the legislation as passed by the legislature? I can't get the section number, but where it says that the court shall transfer in one of these three circumstances. One of those is an impartial trial cannot be had, and then the very next section says in all venue hearings, no factual proof concerning the merits of the case shall be required. Now, one, was the legislature abolishing a factual resolution by the judge in this case? If so, of course, that leaves several questions. Can the court overcome that by subsequent rulemaking power? Or, alternatively, is there a constitutional implication? And then after all that, I've got another question.
All right, Your Honor. With respect to the reference in now Civil Practice and Remedies Code 15063 to impartial trial transfer motions, and recognizing that there is no legislative history to explain the meaning of that inclusion in Section 15.063 because of the nature of the process that led to amended Article 1995. The issue is, in fact, raised as to whether, from a due order standpoint, a due order of pleading standpoint, that a motion to transfer venue on the basis that an impartial trial cannot be obtained in the county of suit is something that must be filed before any other motion. This had never been the motion to change venue law before, for the simple reason that the issue might not arise as to the unfairness of the form until after the due order of pleading timetable would have been through. I would point out to the court from the standpoint of judicial construction of the statute that the statute also talks about consent transfer and imposes a due order rule there if taken completely and slavishly literal. That makes the least amount of sense of all that someone would need to file a motion to transfer venue in due order in order to ultimately obtain a consent transfer, although one could suggest that the statute does in fact say that. This court, in promulgating its procedural rules, and particularly Rule 86 and the sentence that I mentioned, engaged in the process of construing the statute in light of the purposes behind impartial trial venue and the other venue provisions by making it clear that there is no due order requirement for impartial trial motions or for consent transfer motions. I believe what this court was attempting to do was to harmonize the statutory provisions with the prior law in light of the problems that the legislation that led to the amended venue statute was dealing with. From the standpoint of constitutional questions...
What if they can't be harmonized?
What if they can't be harmonized?
Right.
Well, I think that they can, but if they can't be harmonized, then we do get to a question of unfair trial and the constitutional dimensions of unfair trial law. Across the hall, the Court of Criminal Appeals has in fact dealt with this issue in two relatively recent decisions construing companion provisions in the Code of Criminal Procedure that are basically the same and come from the same source as our rules 257 through 259. In O'Brien versus State and Henley versus State, the Court of Criminal Appeals held that it would be an abuse of discretion and a denial of due process for the trial court to overrule motions to change venue without affording a pretrial hearing to present evidence. The holdings are premised on the defendant's constitutional right to an impartial trial under the Texas and federal constitutions. We submit, Your Honors, that if the due order principle would be imposed on impartial trial venue changes, that there would be a constitutional issue as to the propriety of canceling out someone's opportunity to litigate the fair trial issue at the threshold before the issue might even arise.
Now, one more question. This court has recently amended Rule 128 to be effective September 1 and added proof by affidavit in there on special appearance hearings. Is this the same kind of situation? Both sides can have affidavits? I mean, a side can file an affidavit, but if it's controverted by a meaningful affidavit, then constitutionally the court cannot determine special appearance without bringing in either deposition or live proof?
I think it is the same kind of thing, Your Honor, and in fact 258 was supplemented in 1983 by a second sentence that authorizes the parties to make discovery products part of the record by attaching them to proper affidavits. Nothing in that sentence suggests even remotely that the tried by the judge language would be read out of the rule and made inoperative from the standpoint of someone being able to present live testimony.
So your bottom line, if the statute cannot be harmonized with the rule, is that a trial judge can never constitutionally decide a disputed fact question without proof that it has had the opportunity for cross-examination?
Well, Your Honor, never.
Does that go too far?
That probably goes too far. But our position, our bottom line position is that the right to a fair trial is a right of constitutional dimensions, that this does call for the opportunity to present live testimony, to cross-examine witnesses, to subpoena witnesses, to examine them in court, subject to the trial judge's regulation of the entire procedure. And this is what 258 has meant when there is a triable issue of fact, and what we submit it still means, even in light of the other changes.
So the crux of it to you is the right, I apologize to the court, this is a complicated case. The crux of it to you is the right to a fair trial, and the crux of it is not tried by the judge, forces the judge to weigh testimony that's something other than affidavits on each side.
I'm not sure I'm following. The crux of it to us is a tried...
Where do you see the constitutional infirmity? Is simply that one's right to a fair trial, which 257 through 259 guarantees, requires, if there is a controversy among parties on whether the trial is fair or not, a full opportunity for a determination by the judge. And you do not see a constitutional infirmity in a procedural requirement or a statutory requirement that would require a judge to look at two affidavits and make a determination of which one was credible, which one was true, based on dueling affidavits. I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not sure I'm following. I think those may be the same thing.
I suppose the question, do you have to have a full-blown hearing with live testimony, or can you just do it on affidavits?
If there's a controverted issue of fact, Your Honor, say you can't do it just simply on affidavits. And at least in a case like this, where the controversy is significant.
In our procedure, where a trial judge can decide a disputed issue of fact just based on a opposing affidavits?
We have no such procedure as far as when the affidavits are placed in contest.
When the affidavits are in contest, then the trial judge has to have a deposition or a live testimony or something else to assist in weighing the credibility of the witness. Just basically, that is the right of cross-examination.
I think in our procedure, the right to trial includes that. And we don't, in the 128 context or in any other context with which I'm familiar, let there be trial by affidavit unless summary judgment is proper.
Have a little judicial gloss on the amendment we just made.
Pardon me, Your Honor?
128 needs a little judicial gloss on it when it adds the word affidavit in there in terms of acceptable proof.
But 128 does make it quite clear that there is no cancellation of the right to present live testimony in the normal way. The affidavit practice is merely supplementary.
How does this square with the attempts by both the legislature and the court to prevent full-blown hearing on change of venue? The statute so evidences that legislative intent, with the understanding that the decision that's been made on venue is reviewable. I'm not seeing any requirement that we resort to a full-blown trial in one situation where prejudice is alleged and not have a full-blown situation on the mere venue facts, which it's been referred to here as just being a perfunctory examination. But it is reviewable on appeal, is it not, in either circumstance?
Yes, Your Honor, it is reviewable on appeal.
So whoever loses on the affidavit battle, let's say, is not foreclosed from asserting that as error on appeal.
No, Your Honor, not foreclosed. The difficulty in making the assertion in the conventional venue area on appeal is aided by other statutory language that clearly does apply to venue determinations, proper venue determinations. The difficulty in the conventional, in the unconventional, or change of venue practice would not be aided by that statutory language. And the principal issue would be one of showing harm as to the venue determination in the change of venue context.
Having a 6-week hearing on venue doesn't square to me with the legislative mm-hmm. and the court's intent of some time back to eliminate this as a major source of trial and appeal prior to even getting to the merits of the case. And I'm just wondering how we can reconcile it. I'm not sure if I can answer that question right now.
I can answer it. There are 2,000 plaintiffs in this case, or more than 2,000 plaintiffs, and 400 defendants, approximately.
Uh-huh.
That's a fairly unusual kind of case. This type of practice on the criminal side of the docket, these hearings don't take more than an afternoon.
How do you preserve error without a normal hearing? Prove your point with regards to prejudice.
Well, it's difficult.
To follow up to Spears' question that we ought not perhaps have a normal hearing.
If we lose but we review this again on the basis of your trial record, what kind of trial evidence would you put in? Did I see your question?
That's a better question.
Well, one of the things that would have happened at this hearing is that plaintiffs who had been subpoenaed to testify at the hearing with respect to their relationships affinity-wise and consanguinity-wise would presumably have honored the subpoenas and testified. That information simply wasn't available or obtainable for a variety of reasons in discovery and otherwise prior to this venue hearing, and even now, this change of venue hearing.
How many witnesses did you plan to put on at that hearing?
I don't know the exact number, Your Honor, but there were a number of them, including expert witnesses with respect to surveys and attitudes.
Approximate number?
I think in terms of timing, that the ultimate determination would likely have yielded something in the range of 2 weeks. Rather than 6 weeks, number of leaving into account the witnesses that the other side would have called challenging the survey.
And any of the witnesses that were planned, was the testimony of any of the witnesses was planned incapable of being reduced to affidavit form?
Well, for the plaintiffs who were subpoenaed, yes. That couldn't have been put in affidavit form by the defendants because that information was unavailable.
By deposition it was it not?
It's conceivable that depositions could have been taken of one or more of the subpoenaed plaintiffs.
The right of cross-examination in terms of a deposition would have been preserved irrespective of the affidavits.
Who would judge the credibility reading a deposition? Would the court, would we judge it or the trial court? Who would review it?
Well, one would suppose that if this is to be tried on paper, if credibility is an issue, if it doesn't cease to be an issue as a matter of practicality, that it would be the trial judge. And one would further suppose that unless that matter would just simply be left to the trial judge's discretion without regard to what it looked like on appeal, that it might be a question for the appellate courts to consider on the same basis with the same, or perhaps not the same, but on some basis or another, some different basis than the basis we usually use to resolve disputed issues of material fact.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. With the court's permission, I'll give an extra 5 minutes.
May it please this honorable court, the dispositive question in this mandamus proceeding is whether the relators are entitled to present live testimony at an impartial trial venue hearing. In this case, this question is resolved solely from the statutes and the rules.
Mr. Campbell, is it correct that you let the defendants to believe that you were going to have a psyche hearing in an auditorium and the judge had taken 6 to 8 weeks as scheduled for this hearing, and then you in fact bushwhacked or ambushed them on the day of the hearing?
Judge Gonzalez, that, like many other statements that were made in this argument, are untrue.
You did not exchange lists?
We exchanged a pretrial order. A witness list of expert witnesses was named that would, quote, give testimony. There was not a witness list that witnesses that would be called live anywhere.
This is for the hearing, not for the trial.
This is for the impartial venue hearing.
Was a 6 or 8 week hearing scheduled?
Your Honor, what the court scheduled, whether he scheduled was scheduled on his docket or not, I don't know. There was lots of talk. Every time a defendant would get in the courthouse, there was lots of talk that the trial would take 6 to 8 weeks.
Do you concede that the judge only, I noticed there was a several month gap between the date of this hearing and the date the judge signed an order. And I also gathered from the record that supplemental documents were sent in to the judge by the relators during this gap period. Is that right so far?
It is my understanding that the court considered from the time, the date the hearing was to start until the date that the court ruled that that additional items were filed, that the court considered those that were filed up until the time of ruling. If I'm incorrect, I'll check that
well,
as soon as we get through and let you know.
But I just wondered
or to the time of the at the end of the scheduled hearing.
That's right.
That's correct.
That's what his order said.
That is correct.
In other words, as I got the time period, there was 2 days of the hearing.
That's correct.
Then there was a 3 month gap before the ruling was made.
That is correct.
Other things were filed during that 3 month gap, but it's clear from the judge's order, and I just wanted to make sure everybody agreed on that, the judge did not consider anything subsequently filed during this gap.
That is my understanding, Your Honor.
He only considered what was filed, I guess, by the close of business the day after the day of the hearing opened.
That is my understanding.
Okay. So, all right.
And was there any request made at that hearing to extend the time for consideration when this change was made from oral to written, to extend the time for the filing of depositions or affidavits?
I am certain there was, Your Honor.
Was it opposed by UPA?
The opposition came at the very beginning the opposition at the very opening of the hearing, where we did in fact oppose. See, we had this. We had in fact given notice of the filing of depositions under Rule 257 and 258, very specific, Your Honor, as to our compliance with that rule. And so at that point, yes, we did object to the filing of any additional affidavits at that point in time. In construing a statute, this court is guided by the principle recently laid down in May of 1990 in Marino versus Sterling Drug. I think it's very important that I read just a portion of that, where it says Marino's argument that the discovery rule should be applied to Section 16.003 as a matter of statutory construction ignores the plain language of a statute. Where language in a statute is unambiguous, this court must seek the intent of a legislature as found in the plain and common meaning of the words and terms used. Now, in venue, the Constitution also speaks to the role of the courts and the legislature. Section 3, page 45, page 2 of the outline. The power to change the venue in civil and criminal cases is vested in the courts to be exercised in such a manner as shall be provided by law, and the legislature shall pass laws for that purpose. As we go to construe the laws or statutes that were passed, the court is again guided by the statutes on statutory construction, page 3. Except as provided in subsection B, words shall be given their ordinary meaning. So the entire venue scheme, and we get now to pass on to venue, on page 4 of the outline, that the entire venue scheme was changed in 1983 by Senate Bill 898. For this bill, there was no legislative history made. And by agreement, it was agreed there would be no history of legislative intent. But as Price says in his article, legislative intent can be determined by following the passage of the bill through the House and the Senate. On page 4, we have this bill as originally introduced. It says, hearings. In all venue hearings, no factual proof concerning the merits of the case shall be required to establish venue. But the court shall determine venue questions from the pleadings, and no interlocutory appeal shall lie from such determination.
Was there a differentiation made between requests for change of venue based on statutory provisions? Or as vis-a-vis, because you can't get a fair trial in a county, any distinction made between those two in the legislation anyway?
Mr. Justice Spears, there is. And if the court will permit me, I will get to it in just a minute.
Okay.
The Senate Jurisprudence Committee amended SB 898 by providing that the venue would be determined on pleadings and affidavits, but still it retained the language, no interlocutory appeal shall lie from such determination. Now the important thing about this passage of SB 898, this section, is that the very first words in all three of it says, in all venue hearings. It refers to all of them. Okay, from SB 898 was finally passed, and then the general provisions, section 4, which we have on the board and which is on page 5, provide the general provisions and provide the area in which there is a distinction in the various categories of venue. Now, nowhere except in the history of this particular lawsuit has there ever been a term conventional venue. In this lawsuit, it is all lawsuits, there is either proper or improper venue, and there is impartial trial venue. But as far as SB 898 is concerned and the following laws, they're all venue questions. And as Section 4, the court will follow with me, has touched every facet of venue law. Section 4, general provisions. joined or defendants or claims. When two or more parties are joined as defendants in the same action and one or two more claims or causes of action are properly joined in one action, the court has venue of an action or claim against any one defendant. The court has venue of all interaction against all defendants unless one more of the claims or causes of action is governed by Section 2 requiring transfer upon proper objection to the mandatory county. So we're talking about mandatory. Section B goes into counterclaims, cross-claims, and third-party claims. Venue of the main action shall establish venue of a counterclaim, cross-claim, or third-party claim. And then it gets to transfer. It gets them to the impartial trial venue. The court, upon motion filed and served concurrently with or before the filing of the answer, shall transfer an action to another county of proper venue where, parenthesis C, an impartial trial cannot be had in the county where the action is pending. Then he goes on to D, hearings. In all venue hearings, no factual proof concerning the merits of the case shall be required to establish venue. The court shall determine venue questions from the pleadings and affidavits. No interlocutory appeal shall lie from such determination. Your Honors, that is a general, all-inclusive statement. It has no limiting factors. It says, in all venue hearings. Now we come to the limiting part.
Excuse me, Mr. Judge Campbell, but it says no factual proof concerning the merits of the case. I take it no one in this case is attempting to put on evidence of the merits of either a claim or defense in this case.
That is correct, Your Honor.
So that sentence really doesn't apply. The defendants don't claim in this case that you're required to make some sort of showing that your claim is meritorious.
Your Honor, I was attempting to show how the broad general categories of Section 4. The very next sentence is the sentence upon which this case is based. The court shall venue questions from the pleadings and affidavits. Another general, okay, all-inclusive.
You filed depositions, did you not?
Yes, sir.
Those were improper. Did you file those just kind of lead the court down the primrose path of error?
We filed those in...
The court's not to consider those under your reading of this statute.
We filed those, Your Honor, in compliance with Rules 257 and 258.
Well, 257 and 258 trump the statute. Let's get to that question first. I mean, what do we do? You have a statute here that you say limits the trial judge to considering pleadings and affidavits.
That's correct.
And then a rule that expressly mentions any party may file depositions as part of trying this issue. Is the rule in conflict with the statute?
No, and the rule, we don't have to even guess about that, Your Honor, because this court, in promulgating that rule, tells you why it did it. The historical note says it is amended to conform to the requirements of Senate Bill 898. There's no question about that.
So you can have deposition testimony.
Certainly,
Your Honor. Subject to cross-examination.
Yes, sir.
Presented to the judge.
Yes, sir.
And so the judge will then have testimony that he can look at that's been where there's been cross-examination and can make a factual determination from that. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor. And if we could turn quickly to in the outline to and on the what's in the big bill there 257 and look at old 257 and new 257, then it speaks to this. We've got to bear in mind that the amendment of these rules was to place the conformity or in agreement with the statutes.
Well, I would like to recognize that any time we said something consistent, it was. But
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't know.
That's all right. Never mind.
Both 257 and 258, as provided in the rules of procedure, provide that they are promulgated to conform to Senate Bill 898, 68th Legislature, 1983. this statute